listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carl Frisch filling in on the Tom Hartman Program live from Radio Row at the Families USA Health Action Conference here in Washington, D.C. Filling in for Tom today, I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch or like me on Facebook, facebook.com/Carl Frisch. We've got a great setup here right in the heart of, in the thick of things at Families USA Health Care Action Conference. We've got a great lineup of guests coming to you all afternoon and evening. Joining us first is Max Richmond. He is the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Boy, what a job they have out for themselves with all the crazy talk going on in Washington. Max, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So, it seems like everywhere you look today, you've got these so-called leaders in Washington who think that the snake oil that we all need to take to solve our nation's economic problems is to toy with the retirement guarantee of Social Security and the health care guarantee of Medicare for our seniors. It must drive you crazy.
Well, that's an understatement. It's it has been a challenging year and a half, 2 years on these issues, because we have, as you probably know, we've come up to a number of different deadlines, crises.
Man-made crises. Conservative-made crises.
Yes, and unfortunately, we've had to, they're fictitious, but we've had to deal with the reality of the politics here. And so far, we've managed to prevent Social Security from being cut. We've managed to prevent the cost of living adjustment formula from being altered that would, in effect, reduce benefits from what they would be otherwise. We prevented the age for being eligible for Medicare from being raised. There's a lot of talk to raise it to 67 or 70, and we've been able to suppress that. But it's endless.
Well, now people use code language to try and talk about, to make it sound more thoughtful when they're talking about changing Social Security and Medicare. They say things like, you know, to confuse the American public so they don't think that anything's in jeopardy. They'll say something like, you know, Social Security chained consumer price index. What does that mean, and how scary should that be to Americans?
Well, everybody that receives Social Security, they're almost as familiar with the term COLA as they are with Social Security itself. COLA is a cost of living adjustment. Most years, there's a little bump added to the monthly check, supposedly to keep up with inflation, so as a beneficiary, you don't fall behind from year to year. And the formula that's used to develop what the COLA should be is the Consumer Price Index. This new idea that's been floated and gotten a lot of traction from not just Republicans, but Democrats, independents, is, as you called it, the chain CPI. And the idea is behind it is substitution. If something price of something goes up, the idea is consumers will shift to something cheaper. That doesn't make a lot of sense especially for seniors that don't have that kind of mobility, flexibility. They can't change from some prescription they're taking to something else. They have limitations in how they get around. And it's really a flawed formula. And what bothers me, what you said drive me crazy, what drives me crazy is the effort to convince seniors that this is all designed to make the COLA more accurate.
Right.
And by the way, it's going to be smaller.
Right.
And even the formula that's used today is not place the proper weight on those goods and services that seniors rely on. And therefore, even the COLA that was received under the current formula, which has been in place since 1974, is flawed and does not provide enough of an increase for Social Security benefits to keep up with inflation. So we're going to trade a flawed formula for an even more deeply flawed formula. Right, right.
So you've got these people in Washington that talk about this as if it's going to solve our debt issues, our deficit issues. Social Security has nothing to do with our debt or our deficit, does it?
Absolutely not. It hasn't contributed a single penny to the federal debt, which is serious.
Sure.
And hasn't contributed a penny to the annual deficits that we've been running since 2000-2001. So why in the world are we now, you know, some people ask me, well, why is this happening? Why is this so much talk and focus on Social Security when it hasn't caused an increase in the debt or the deficits? And I remind them of a famous bank robber back in the 30s, Willie Sutton, was asked, why do you rob banks? So that's where the money is. Social Security has $2.7 trillion in reserve by design, built up since the early 80s, for the purpose of paying benefits to the baby boomers who, like myself, are just entering retirement. And this money was paid in to pay benefits, not to be a bargaining chip to deal with federal debt that the Social Security program had nothing to do with. And I think we're over time gaining a support as people begin to understand what you just said. And I'm glad you're on your program. We have a chance to get that message out, that Social Security is not part of the problem, should not be part of the solution.
Well, it's not just that they're talking about, right? I mean, they're talking about a number of things. They're talking about changing the way that Medicare benefits are paid for, shifting the cost to the Medicare consumers.
Yeah, that is really tragic because Medicare is a great program. But there's a lot of healthcare costs, medical costs that Medicare does not cover. Doesn't cover vision care, doesn't cover dental care, doesn't cover hearing loss, hearing aids, batteries for hearing aids. So that's why seniors count on the COLA, for example, because they have such high out-of-pocket costs for health care. And to now, rather than looking at solving the true problems with Medicare, the idea is let's have seniors pay more. Let's cut the program.
And the whole notion is they don't have the funds to pay more. That's why we're helping.
Exactly. And what we really need to do, and I have to say the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, if you will, went a long way towards addressing overall health care costs, because that's what we have to do is control health care costs. And
it did that by shifting the incentives, right?
Exactly.
Keeping people healthy versus paying for a bunch of tests or for unneeded medication, but making sure that you're doing screenings and preventative.
Right. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because in the last couple of campaigns, the presidential and the congressional in 2010, there was so much misinformation about health care reform, cutting $716 billion out of Medicare, and the implication was seniors were being hurt. Couldn't be further
Baloney,
from the truth.
Right.
Baloney. Well, you're polite. I'd say something else.
We're not on the board.
Baloney is a good way to describe it. Under the Affordable Care Act, the things you just mentioned are available with no out-of-pocket costs for the first time ever under Medicare.
Close the donut loophole.
Close the donut hole. All the screening that you mentioned, diabetes screening, mammograms, colonoscopies, no out-of-pocket costs. So right now,
the thinking being that if you can get in front of these things before they become a crisis, you can save a lot more money.
Exactly. Unfortunately, the Congressional Budget Office doesn't score that kind of, I guess, speculative saving.
Right.
But it makes common sense if you're going to have
perfect sense.
And millions and millions of Medicare beneficiaries have availed themselves of these screenings because they're available without out-of-pocket costs. And the savings in the $716 billion in savings that allowed for these programs to be improved, the screening, the closing of the donut hole, those savings came out of Medicare provider reimbursement rates.
It's why we've got to keep on fighting. Max Richman.
Thank you so much.
He's the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Follow them online, ncpssm.org, ncpssm. On Twitter. Max, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in all afternoon. I'm Carl Frisch, and we will be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Got it fixed in the nick of
time. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. We are here live at Families USA Healthcare Action 2013 here in Washington, D.C. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-TOM. That's 866 877-987-8466. We're talking about healthcare in a variety of different ways all afternoon. And joining me today, right now, to talk about, you know, the disparities that we see in the treatment and healthcare received by people of color, and women and other minority groups is Daniela Gibbs Leger. Daniela, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So I think we all know that healthcare is not received by people of color or in the color community or LGBT people.
That's right.
Or women, and frankly, the poor as well, in the same way that, that other folks are getting it. How bad is the disparity?
The disparities are pretty awful when you look at it, and especially among children, despite the fact that there is the Children's Health Insurance Program. When you look at rates of obesity and diabetes among kids of color, it is really bad. And you know that if you start out as a child having health problems, it's going to follow you for the rest of your life.
Well, and in urban areas, I mean, you've got an epidemic that's been around since the 60s of no access to sometimes a grocery store.
Right.
And then if you do have a grocery store, good produce.
Exactly. It's all just it's a terrible downward spiral. And oftentimes in many of these communities, a Planned Parenthood might be the only access to any type of preventable care that you have. And then, of course, you saw, you know, the Republicans last year really try to shut a lot of them down. So, you know, communities of color are just facing tons of barriers economically and in healthcare, and it all sort of compounds itself. So that's why the Affordable Care Act was really so crucial.
What did the Affordable Care Act do to kind of try and solve these issues?
Well, you know, access is a huge problem, but affordability is a problem. And if you are, you know, looking on the individual market for healthcare as a poor individual, it's really, really hard, next to impossible, to find anything. So with these exchanges that are going to be set up, or with the expansion of Medicaid, depending on where you live, now millions of more people will be able to actually afford healthcare coverage and not have to pay exorbitant premiums, because that's what prevents people from getting
it. Well,
and
coverage. One thing that I don't think people talk about very often is, you know, if you go a long time without having health insurance, odds are, and I've gone without health insurance for years at a time, odds are that you don't get certain things treated, then they become an issue, and they become a big problem. And then those are what insurance companies call pre-existing conditions.
Exactly.
So, you know, if you have preventative care, those things never, you know, metastasize into a huge issue.
Right.
So they're not pre-existing conditions or anything. It's that kind of a disparity that leads to the huge increase in costs on all of us, as well as a lack of access.
Right, exactly. And so the Affordable Care Act obviously got rid of the pre-existing condition rule, which is great. But you're right. There are all these lots of people who will now be coming into the system who haven't had health care for years, and they may actually, you know, have some pre-existing conditions. But, you know, luckily for younger folks who now will be able to get in and stay in, especially folks, kids who graduate from college and won't have to get off right away, they can keep getting that preventative care so that they don't become an eventual drain on the healthcare system.
And in 2014, it'll be even easier for people to have coverage throughout their entire life.
Right, exactly.
You know, I think the more generationally as we proceed through the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as I like to call it.
It's Obamacare. He cares.
Yeah, and Social Security is FDR cares, and Medicare is Truman care, or LBJ cares. And funny, you don't. I guess the Bush tax cuts are aptly named at that, if that's the score we're putting them on, because he certainly cared for the wealthy.
He sure did.
So these issues of disparity will get better over time.
Yeah, it'll take a while. You know, it's not going to happen overnight. And I think people, you know, sometimes this country, I think Americans, we just want things to happen like right now.
Sure.
Like, why haven't costs gone down? It's going to take a while. But,
and diligence, because it's not like the fight over Planned Parenthood has stopped.
Right. And it's not like there aren't Republicans in Congress right now who are trying to figure out ways to weaken the Affordable Care Act, you know, every day.
Well, and here, you know, I just remind people every single time I talk about it, Planned Parenthood. And I have no problem saying this because it's true. Nearly every dollar spent at Planned Parenthood has nothing to do with abortion.
3%. That is it. 3% of their services are about abortion.
Right.
I mean, that's a 97% is about, you know, mammograms and other preventative care. And again, and so, I think a lot of times that
they're also basic health care.
It's basic.
It's not just healthcare. Women's health that they're dealing with. It.
Right.
You know, if you they do flu shots. I mean, they do.
They do so much, and people just don't understand. And
every woman that I know has been to Planned Parenthood for any number of issues.
Right, right. And in many parts of this country, again, like, that's it. That's right. All you're going to get when it comes to health care. And I think a lot of times that people in D.C., especially when they're fighting these battles, I'm like, do you know any real people outside of the Beltway
right.
who actually rely on your services?
Or maybe do you know any people in the Beltway? Because I know plenty of women who use Planned Parenthood today in Washington, D.C.
Exactly, exactly.
And Virginia and Maryland, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it drove me insane during that debate.
Well, and, you know, I think what the right does oftentimes, they know that the life or choice issue gets people riled up on the right.
Yes.
So they see something. First of all, they also don't like government money being spent on anything other than tax cuts.
Uh-huh.
So this is not really
or defense.
This is not really just about choice.
Mm-hmm.
If it was just about choice, you'd see thoughtful people in the pro-life movement,
yes.
The anti-choice movement, making suggestions that we will increase funding for Planned Parenthood
right.
in these ways,
mm-hmm.
but we will cut funding in these ways. You can tell that they're not being honest and legitimately sincere in their protestations because, yeah, okay, you're pro-life. I get that. I may disagree with you, but that's a fundamental philosophy difference that we can
right.
have. We all agree that women should have access to quality and affordable health care. So if you really cared, you do that.
Right. And if you really want to reduce the number of abortions, how about providing birth control?
Ah.
I know.
But they don't want us
radical.
Having sex either.
That's true.
If you're just joining us, we've been talking to Daniela Gibbs Leger. She's the Vice President of American Values and New Communities at the Center for American Progress. Daniela, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
All right. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in all afternoon, I am Carl Frisch, and I want to hear from you. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Follow me on Twitter, too, at Carl Frisch. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, Executive Director of the Young Invincibles, Aaron Smith. Don't miss it. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom all afternoon, I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. Find me on Facebook at Carl Frisch. We're going to take a quick call from Todd in Kirkland, Washington. Todd, thanks for joining us. You've got a question about how we can save more money in healthcare, Todd.
They're one of the largest industries in the country. It's somewhere north of $25 trillion a year. And the figures that have been reported, 20 to 30% of this
sure.
is spent on record keeping and on the profits of the insurance industry.
Right.
Now, we want to maintain some of the spending for the record keeping, which is the best in the world, although it can be improved. But we can save like $3 to $5 trillion a year on the record, just the purely billing and profit component.
Well, I know where you're going with this, Todd. I think you're going to say that we need single payer, right?
Universal single payer, you bet. And I think
Todd, I don't want to cut you off. We've got a big lineup of guests here, but I will say I couldn't agree more that we need single payer, but we're not there, which means we've got to work within the system until we get there, and that means making whatever we've got the best it can be. So I thank you for your call, Todd. If you want to give us a call, toll free 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Excuse me. Joining us now is the executive director and co-founder of Young Invincibles, which you can find online at younginvincibles.org. Aaron Smith, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
So one of the things that came out this week, and I think that, you know, we talk about the personal security of people. We've been talking a lot about healthcare, but one of the things that plays into the security we feel as human beings, it's not just healthcare, but it's also how secure we feel in our employment. And the January jobs numbers came out, and it was 157,000 new jobs added to the rolls, but it shows young workers falling even further behind. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. We've seen the numbers. Unfortunately, young workers don't always share in the job gains that we saw. We actually saw youth unemployment tick up about 1.5%, over 13%. It's actually much worse for certain populations. So, for example, young African Americans, unemployment's about 28%. So not only is that a huge issue for this population, but it's a huge issue for the whole the economy, really. If we're, you know, if these young people don't have that chance to get a good job when they're younger and to advance up the chain, we know that there's actually long-term impacts on the wages that they're going to make. We've seen...
And not just their wages, but their health, too. I mean, if you look at people who struggle to find their niche in the employment world, young, they end up having, for whatever reason, usually because health care is tied to employment, they end up having health problems down the line.
Well, and we are also seeing, just as a systemic matter, young people more and more have jobs where they don't get access to benefits. Right now, young people are only about 50% get employer-based insurance.
Right.
More and more, they're relying on either going uninsured or they're relying on a private market, which is one of the reasons why the new health care law will actually be a big benefit to
young adults. Especially if they're pursuing careers, right? If you are a writer, or if you are somebody who wants to work in television, or if you want to work in radio, or any number of other industries, and you're taking what used to be a full-time job with benefits at one of these industries, but they're calling it a fellowship or an internship, you're working just as many hours as the person, you know, the person sitting next to you, or the person you work for, but you're not getting anything. You might be getting a stipend that isn't minimum wage, and you're not getting any benefits.
Well, and you throw on top of that things like rising cost of college, student loan debt, and an economy that might be slowly improving but is not improving nearly fast enough for young people, and you've got sort of a perfect storm, if you will.
Well, and they call it, you know, they say 60 is the new, 30. I'm beginning to think they say 60 is the new 30 because it's like your kids move back home with you, and it's like you're 30 all over again with young kids in the house.
I mean, we actually see some of the challenges facing people in their early 30s is not all that different from
right.
people who just got out of school and they're 22 nowadays, because it can take a while to get your career on track. And, you know, certainly you see some of these issues around health care, student loans are as bad, if not worse, for folks in their early 30s. So there are some bright spots. Like I said, the job numbers are slowly getting better, but the policy atmosphere is one of cutting. And that's exactly the wrong approach. Why would you want to cut a program like AmeriCorps, which actually provides jobs for 80,000 young people?
See, that's where you're getting it wrong. You're thinking logically. People who want to cut these programs, they say it nicely, but what they really want to say is, we don't think we should spend any money except on big business, big corporations, and tax cuts for the extremely wealthy. They don't believe in Medicare. They don't believe in Social Security. They don't believe in programs for young people. They want you to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, even if they're not your boots.
Well, the crazy thing and the strange thing is that traditionally there has been bipartisan support for things like Pell Grants that make college more affordable, for job training programs that help all Americans try to get into the middle class and get a decent job. And
you are so 2005,
I know,
2009.
I'm behind the times here. But
yeah.
for whatever
In the
reason,
Obama era, if he says go, they say stop. If he says blue, they say red. He could even take their idea and coin it as his own, and they would say, no, we're against that now. So I think the bipartisan thing, you know, you've got, if you look at the right now, and I know that you're a non-partisan organization, but you've got people like Mitch McConnell, who is more worried about being primaried in his own state than he is with leading in the United States Senate. One of the stories that came out that you guys have up on your website, which people can visit at younginvincibles.org, yesterday, Inside Higher Ed reported that the Obama administration on Wednesday proposed that student health plans funded by colleges rather than operated by insurance companies can qualify as minimum essential coverage, basically saying that, you know, if your school offers health plans, that can cover as the required insurance. What do you make of that?
So just to provide a little background, there's about 2 to 3 million students out there on student health plans. I was on a student health plan. It's very common, especially if your parents don't have coverage. So traditionally, those plans have been all over the map in terms of quality. We actually worked to make sure that those plans got basically the same benefits as all other plans under the health care law. So you can't discriminate in pre-existing conditions, get rid of the benefit caps, free preventive care, all that important stuff. Now, there's a category called self-insured plans, which are actually small but growing. Things like the UC system
yeah.
is a self-insured self-insured plan, and the new regs basically say that those plans are in some ways exempt from some of these basic protections, and we think that's a big problem.
Sure.
Because students.
I mean, this is the same problem that we have with the insurance industry as a whole, when you've got one state saying that you can have pre-existing conditions as a disqualifier, and another state saying you can't. And
exactly. We need the same baseline level of consumer protections for everyone, and students are no exception. You know, certainly young people may not get sick as much, but we also go to the emergency room. We also get sick. We also get
things
like
cancer. We fall off
cliffs.
We have car accidents.
And we need coverage that's actually going to be there for us. And so I think, you know, we're going to definitely be making sure that our voice is heard. All the young people that we work with, their voices are heard to say, you know, we need to improve that. Because overall, you know, the healthcare law has huge benefits for young people. Almost 17 million uninsured young people right now can get Medicaid or new subsidies to make insurance more affordable than it's ever been before.
Well, and it has
to say it's perfect.
A lasting impact. The earlier young people have insurance, the earlier they start being insured for the rest of their lives, the more we will save over time. If you look at young people who have had access to quality health insurance from the time they were born, very lucky people, if that continues through their entire life, think of all of the other conditions that can be caught and screened through preventative health care that we won't end up having to pay fortunes for in the long term.
And you look at health issues like asthma or diabetes, which we know are increasingly common. You need consistent treatment. You need preventive care. And that's got to continue throughout your life. And I agree with you. Not only is that going to be better for people's health, but it's going to bring down costs in the overall system, which is going to make insurance more affordable for everyone. So,
well, one of the things
it's a big issue
that you all have, if you go to Young Invincibles, you've got a program called Friends with Benefits, which had an entirely different meaning when I was in college. But you're helping people connect to find where they can get quality health care.
Exactly. So we just want to make it as easy as possible for young people to know about their new options and to get actually to buy insurance or to get insurance for free. So we created a new mobile app. It's a free mobile app. You can download it on Android or iPhone. That'll basically help you connect to the new marketplaces, the exchanges. They have frequently asked questions about the healthcare law. There's a lot of confusion out there.
Sure.
How much is this going to cost me? What is this
mandate? When do I see my death panel?
Exactly.
Oh, wait, I think those are probably the 80-year-olds.
When can I actually sign
people.
Up? I'll just say October 1 is when the open enrollment starts. You know, so there's just a lot of information. So it's really a big part of our mission to make sure people have all the facts and, you know, they actually understand the value that's out there, because this is really a game changer for young adults in terms of their health, in terms of the economic security that they see. And I think it'll have lasting implications. You know, when a young person knows that they can move job to job, be entrepreneurial, find the career that makes sense, and not lose health benefits, I think that has huge implications for our whole economy.
I think the entire notion that we would live like our parents did. My father had the same job for 35 years. My mother had the same job for 30 years.
It just doesn't happen anymore.
I can't even count the number of jobs I've had in my adult life. And which makes the notion that we would have the same system that our parents had for healthcare completely infeasible. This is the Tom Hartman Program. We've been talking to Aaron Smith. He's the executive director and co-founder of Young Invincibles. Aaron, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
You can visit more information about them at younginvincibles.org. You can also follow them on Twitter, YI_care. We've got a lot more coming to you live from the Families USA conference here in Washington, D.C. This is Carl Frisch filling in for Tom Hartman, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, Gordon Bunnyman. He is an attorney and executive director of the Tennessee Justice Center. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, 10 minutes to the top of the hour. Filling in for Tom all afternoon, I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. Find me on Facebook. Wherever you want to find me, I'm there. Joining me now, we are at the Families USA Health Action Conference 2013 here in Washington, D.C. And joining me now is Gordon Bunnyman. He is the executive director of the Tennessee Justice Center. He's a former Families USA board member. He's practiced poverty law since 1973, with much of his advocacy work focusing on healthcare financing, quality and access, including nursing home litigation, advocacy for home and community-based services, etc. Gordon, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Carl. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. So the Tennessee Justice Center helps folks solve their problems when it comes to this type of stuff. Tell me about the work.
Well, we started out representing low-income people. We actually have some people who are middle-income. We found that to be poor when it comes to health care, you don't literally have to be poor. Healthcare has gotten so far beyond the means of most ordinary people. If they don't have insurance, then they are out of luck. So,
and sometimes if they have insurance, that's not enough either.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. Many of us are walking around with pieces of plastic in our wallet. We think we're insured. We don't know.
We're actually just collecting plastic.
Exactly. It gives us that warm feeling when we sit down and we feel it in our back pocket.
My name's on it.
Right. It's embossed. Yeah, but just don't get sick.
Yeah.
Just don't get sick.
And if you do, certainly nothing more than the sniffles.
Yeah.
So what's an example of the type of work that the organization does for somebody? Give me, you know, somebody walks in the door. And what do they typically need from you?
They have a child with very significant disabilities and chronic illness, and they've reached a lifetime limit. Now, fortunately, we've been put out of business on that one by the Affordable Care Act, but that has been a lot of our work in the past.
And when you say lifetime limit, what that means is your insurance says, yeah, we'll cover this, but once we reach $500,000, which can be pretty quick,
exactly.
We're not going to pay for it anymore.
Exactly, exactly. Or they are adults with pre-existing conditions, and they can't get coverage. Or they are covered by Medicaid, but Medicaid is not actually giving them access to the services that they need. Or they are on Medicare, and their home health has been denied.
So how much easier does the Affordable Care Act make your job?
It makes our job much easier in terms of ensuring that people will have a way to get coverage. Now, this is dependent on whether our state, which is a red state, decides to accept the federal funds that are being provided to cover people who are working families that are living in or near poverty. And our state, like many red states, has not decided about that yet. If it does decide to do that, then people who are struggling will have a means of getting care. And that's a lot of what we do, is trying to beg, borrow, badger, however we can, get services for people who don't have coverage or, as you point out, have coverage and it turns out not to be worth what they thought it was. So it's going to go a long way towards helping with that if we accept the federal dollars. If we don't accept the federal dollars, people who are above the near poverty level will have access to premium tax credits, will be able to get commercial insurance, and that will be a big help, particularly for some of our middle-income clients.
But again, that's people that meet a income threshold.
Right.
It doesn't really take into consideration the hardship that the cost of this stuff or the cost of the insurance would be, does it?
Well, no, it does, because there's a premium tax credit.
Okay.
So it will subsidize the cost of their insurance. And interestingly, the law is written so that that premium tax credit is available all the way up to 400% of the federal poverty level, which for a family of four is $90,000.
Right.
That tells you something. That's based on studies about what is affordable, and that tells you just how expensive and unaffordable health insurance has become.
That they would have to build such a giant buffer.
Right. Now, you know, of course, most people who have insurance get it through their employer, but if you're not fortunate enough to get it through your job, and you try to just go buy it on the
economy,
market.
And in this economy, a lot of employers, you could have a near full-time job at Walmart where they actually counsel you to go get government insurance. You could be a waitress like my mom and not be offered, even if you're working 45 hours or just under 40 hours a week.
Right.
And you've got a lot of places that are shifting that burden to the government.
Well, if you look right now at who the people are behind the numbers, you've identified one of the main groups, your mom's group. Hospitality workers across the country are the ones, they're working folks, they're working hard, and many, many, many of them do not have insurance and cannot get it right now, and they will benefit from the Affordable Care Act.
And that was the biggest noise we heard when this was being debated, was from people that owned restaurant chains or owned hotel chains saying that they weren't going to put up with this. And in my head, it was always a values argument, you know. instead of saying we're not going to pay for this, what you're actually saying is we don't think our employees deserve health care.
Well, that's some of them. I know other restaurant owners who have not been able to afford to provide insurance, and this will now, you know, they care about their employees, and they will be able to provide coverage for them, or their employees will be able to get it now. So I think it runs the gamut, but we're talking about mending the social contract that's always been there until recent years, which was if you were working, you would be able to have a high expectation of getting insurance coverage. That's gone away, and increasingly those costs are being shifted to people who can't bear them.
Well, and as this moves forward, I mean, you've been involved in this fight for a long time. Did you ever think we'd reach a day after fighting for some kind of a national health care program for 70, 80 years that we'd actually have this in place to help fill some of these holes?
Well, I'm very, very grateful. And I believe that this will be like Social Security. Next year when it starts, it will probably be, there'll be some bumps in the road. But I think 5 years from now, people are going to look back on this and they're going to think, why did we have this big fight about it?
That's why I call it Obamacare. I mean, John Fugelsang likes to say, we'll call it Obamacare, but we're also going to call it Social Security, FDR care, and Medicare, LBJ care.
Right.
And we'll call the Bush tax cuts the Bush tax cuts.
Fair enough.
All right. If you're just joining us, we've been talking to Gordon Bonnieman. He is the executive director of the Tennessee Justice Center, which you can find online at Tennessee Justice Center or tnjustice.org. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in all afternoon. I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back in the next hour. You won't want to miss it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program with you all afternoon. I am Carl Frisch, filling in for Tom, or at least trying to. There are quite some shoes to fill. Find more about me at carlfrisch.com. You can also connect with me on Twitter and Facebook at Carl Frisch. We're talking about healthcare. We are live, hence the video with the weird hostage-taken background. We are live from Families USA Health Action here in Washington, D.C., their annual conference of healthcare reform subjects and healthcare advocacy subjects. Joining me now to talk about this disparity that LGBT people face when it comes to healthcare. Because believe it or not, if we get marriage equality, when we get marriage equality, there are still quite a few things that LGBT people have to confront, whether it's being able to be fired in 30 states simply for being LGBT, whether it's adoption, whether it's housing rights. There are a number of issues that LGBT people confront on a day-to-day basis as they simply try to lead their lives as American. Joining me now is Kellen Baker. He is the health policy analyst at the Center for American Progress and LGBT Progress. Kellen, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Carl.
So, as I said in the little introduction there, LGBT people face unique healthcare challenges as they kind of navigate life. When you supplement or when you look at a life of a gay person like me or somebody else, you've already got to deal with job discrimination. You've already got to deal with housing discrimination. You've already got to deal with maybe not being able to adopt your spouse's child, your own child. But there's also severe healthcare disparities for LGBT people.
And what we see is that things are especially hard for LGBT people because not only do we experience those particular challenges that are specific to the discrimination and the lack of fundamental rights, fundamental access to some of the benefits and services that we need as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender people, but we're also, unfortunately, for many of us, living in this country where the health system is broken for so many people. And so LGBT people face the same challenges as any other people in their families across the country, trying to get health insurance coverage and trying to get health care services when they need it. And so what we see is, as a result, some disparities, some avoidable differences between LGBT people and non-LGBT people that are really due to discrimination, due to stigma, due to fundamentally, though, a lack of access to services.
Well, and you know, one of the ways, and I think this is pretty straightforward, during, I think it was in 2012, may have been 2011, the Obama administration basically dictated through executive order that, through administration policy, that if you are a hospital in the United States that takes government, federal government money, then you can't discriminate against LGBT couples. So, for example, even if your state didn't have a law saying that a lesbian couple, for example, should be able to visit each other in the hospital, even though there's not marriage equality in the state, then if you're a federal hospital taking federal dollars, you have to let them visit each other. That could have been easily wiped away had Obama lost. That policy could have just been changed because it wasn't set in stone in law. But that's an example of the kind of disparity that people experience. Not to mention, if your state doesn't have co-parent adoption, i.e. the idea that a same-sex couple could have the same parental rights and responsibilities of their own children, then what happens if the spouse who's carrying the insurance, the legal guardian of the children, loses their job, and the employer is not obligated to let the other parent's health coverage cover the family?
And this, that's such an example of the way that all of these pieces, all of these forces that affect LGBT people's lives are so interrelated. Because something like marriage equality, as you said earlier, is a health issue. Health is related to marriage, which, because of its close association with insurance coverage in the United States, and the way that it enables families to protect each other. And similarly, looking at insurance coverage from the perspective of as an individual, if you are a transgender person in this country, for example, your entire health history, your entire identity as a human being has traditionally been called a pre-existing condition, and you're told that you can't get coverage for that. And so the health reform law really is a broad-based effort to, as you put it, enshrine some of the protections that not just LGBT people need in the health and health insurance industry, but to expand access to services, to expand access to care for everyone. And LGBT people stand to benefit a great deal from that.
Not to, I mean, even when looking at marriage equality, I mean, it's a fact that married people live longer.
Yes.
So when you're denied these basic fundamental rights, constitutional rights, according to the Supreme Court. We'll see what they say in a matter of months now. But you're also lowering the life expectancy of people.
Yes, because when you're married, not only do you get health insurance coverage, but you have a caretaker in the home should something happen to you. And
but when somebody knows you in a marriage, they notice when you're a little off.
Exactly. And they're able to go with you to the hospital. They're able to communicate with your provider. They're able to set out a long-term care plan for you that both of you can feel confident will be respected. And that is not the case, unfortunately, as you pointed out, Carl, for many same-sex couples in the United States today. And in fact, it's not just the specific issues of access to insurance coverage or access to care. Going back to what you were talking about earlier with stigma and discrimination, there's been a lot of research showing the detrimental health effects, physical and mental health effects, of living in states that have passed anti-gay ballot initiatives, for example. Because we know from a lot of the work that's been done around race and ethnicity and the social stresses of racism that living as a minority or a member of a disadvantaged population in this country is bad for your health. And that is true for LGBT people. It's true, we know, we see what happens with many young people being told that they're not okay because they're gay, that they're not okay because they're transgender or they're gender nonconforming. And that takes its toll, and it takes its toll throughout the lives of LGBT people.
Well, and you know, in nearly 30 states, there is no law saying that a school, a public school, a public institution that we all pay for, cannot discriminate against children or families that are LGBT. And these are the kinds of things. I mean, I would guess that most people listening at home are not LGBT, that they are predominantly heterosexual. And it's always a shocker to people that don't follow the subjects closely when you tell them, okay, even after marriage equality, gay people can still be fired in 30 states. Gay people can be denied renting a home or renting an apartment or leasing an office for their small business in 30 states. You can be denied second parent adoption or joint adoption in more than 30 states. You can, your children, if you have a gay child, can be discriminated in school in 30 plus states, or have no laws against bullying children based on their LGBT or perceived LGBT status in 20-some-odd states. And that's even if marriage equality becomes the norm, if it becomes the rule of law across the entire United States, those things still exist.
Yes, contrary to you, I recently saw an analyst on a news show talking about the different kinds of non-discrimination protections that exist in employment. And he ran down a whole list of protected categories. He said, you know, you're protected from discrimination in employment under federal law on the basis of age and race and sex and sexual orientation. And I was flabbergasted. Because, of course, that's not true.
And a lot of straight people are shocked when they find out.
Yes, and in fact, research from the Center for American Progress shows that 90% of Americans, LGBT and not, believe that there is a federal law protecting LGBT people in employment. Which,
and when they find out there isn't, the numbers of people who support such laws is through the roof.
Yes.
Even way more so. You're talking the 70th percentile. And even in the 60 percentile with Republicans on the subject. If you're just joining us, this is the Tom Hartman Program. We've been talking to Kellen Baker. He is the health policy analyst for the Center for American Progress and LGBT Progress. You can find more about him on Twitter at Kellen E. Baker or AM Progress on Twitter or AmericanProgress.org. Kellen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Carl.
And we've got a lot more great talk about healthcare and other sort of related subjects coming up for you after this break, so stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, we're going to talk to Healthcare for America Now, not later, now. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. You may remember me from Media Matters. I fill in for Tom time to time. You've probably heard me on the Stephanie Miller Show and the Bill Press Show, but you can also follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch or on Facebook at Carl Frisch. Sign up for my email list at carlfrisch.com so you can find out when I'm doing these sorts of things, when I'm going to be on TV and the radio and everything else. We are live this afternoon from Families USA Health Action 2013. It's an annual conference focusing on healthcare policy and action. And joining me now is Ethan Rome. He is the Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, which you can find online at healthcareforamericanow.org or on Twitter at HCAN. Ethan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
One of the things that I find interesting, and maybe it's just me, but I always like to see the interconnectedness of issues. I mean, we don't often think about certain types of policy as health policy, but immigration reform has an element to healthcare in it. If you feel secure in where you are in this country and you're standing in, you know, legality, then you're going to feel more secure getting the types of health care you need for pre-existing conditions because you're not going to be as worried about deportation or any number of reasons that you might not seek care, which leads to saving money because you're getting pre-existing coverage, et cetera. Guns, too. You know, the idea that our guns or the number of guns in this country and guns being used in crime or supposedly for self-defense, it's also a health care issue. You wrote a piece for the Huffington Post where you kind of lay out five reasons why the NRA must be stopped. And the number one reason that you list is the NRA's leaders' immoral interpretation of the Second Amendment presents a serious public health risk. And the reason you know that they know that's true is because they don't want gun deaths or gun accidents or injuries because of guns tracked by the federal government, which we do, by the way, for automobiles, for pharmaceuticals, for any number of other health issues, diseases, prevention, all those other things, so that we have an idea of where we need to tackle these issues. But they don't want it tracked because they know that it would lead to more knowledge about the serious impact that it's having on our national health.
I mean, you are so right about that, and I really appreciate that you've raised it. The biggest way that you know that someone like the leaders of the NRA, that they're lying, is when they explicitly are opposed to any study that would tell the truth.
Well, when you said the way that you know they're lying, I was going to say because their lips are moving.
Right.
But it's true. They don't want any study, and they also don't want any mechanism for having a study.
Right. I mean, listen, there was a poll done recently by the mayor's group that's concerned
sure.
about gun violence.
Mary's Against Illegal Guns.
That's right. And, you know, 74% of NRA members believe that there ought to be the end to the loophole in criminal background checks.
Right.
Not Wayne LaPierre,
you know,
the head of the NRA.
I've been to literally hundreds of gun shows. I was raised in a gun family. My dad is what most liberals would call a gun nut. And I can tell you, you go to a gun show, it would make things a lot easier on, you know, the people selling guns at the gun show if it was the same process for everything. And what occurs to me, if we had these background checks, if we kept better track of the guns that people are purchasing, even if it's between friends, when a gun goes missing, we'll know it's missing, as opposed to having crimes be committed and then all of a sudden, oh, I didn't know my gun wasn't in my house for the last 10 years. These are the kinds of things that we could track if we were keeping track, but they don't want us to have any kind of mechanism for doing that.
Right, and these are common sense laws that would reduce gun violence, not just the mass shootings, the epidemic of mass shootings that we've seen, like in Newtown, Connecticut, but the massive number of deaths every day in cities. Literally every day, and. And this is a public health crisis. Right? And so the Second Amendment's not going anywhere. I mean, if you listen to Wayne LaPierre and the other folks from the high command...
If you can stomach it, yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, the guys from the high command of the NRA do two things every day. One is they disregard what their own members think. Because average gun owners don't say, man, I'm not going to get through this day if I don't have an AK-47. I don't know how I'm going to go hunting.
Right.
Man, you know, I better get one of them. And that's why gun owners overwhelmingly support criminal background checks.
Well, and it's not just that. I mean, the other thing that they do is they're the step and fetchits for the gun industry, not gun users, not hunters and sportsmen and everything else. I mean, if you told the average person who wanted an AK or wanted an assault weapon, you can have one as long as it's stored at a firing range and that it's only used there and that you maintain proper training on it, the average consumer would say, that's fine with me. I like to shoot that gun, and I'm willing to do it someplace safe and have it regulated. The NRA would say, no, no, no. No rules, no nothing. They can do whatever they want with it.
Right. I mean, they have a slippery slope argument that says that anything that would in any way, shape, or form limit people's access to guns. So, for example, the reason I always talk about the background check issue is really simple. 40% of all gun sales get through the loophole for criminal background checks.
Right.
So terrorists who can't board an airplane in the United States
can go to a gun show.
Can go to a gun show and buy an assault rifle.
Well, and we call it the gun show loophole, but it's actually a bigger loophole
than gun show. It's a private sale loophole.
If you and I were buddies,
all
we have to do is say that we're buddies. We don't actually have to know each other. I can sell you a gun as a private sale in the same way that you could go and buy one at a gun show. I think we do ourselves a disservice by calling it the gun show loophole, even though I do it because it's been ingrained in my,
right.
my brain.
It's the private sale loophole. And by the way, we cannot know each other. And you could say, you know what, Ethan? Instead of selling you one Bushmaster, right, the assault rifle used in Newtown, could I sell you a 25?
Right. Yeah.
And then I might choose to resell them.
And that's the truly sick thing. What else have you been focused on? We've got about a minute, less than a minute left before we got to go to a hard break.
We're focused on defending Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security against the Republican assaults. We're focused on demanding...
You mean they're trying to take away something that they were never for?
Yes. I know that this is shocking, and I know it's shocking to people and who are listening, right? Just like we're focused on asking that corporations pay their fair share. GE pays less taxes than anyone who's listening to this program because they pay none.
They pay zero. Ethan Rome, he's the executive director of Healthcare for America Now. Find them online, healthcareforamericanow.org or HCAN on Twitter. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be back after this with more great talk.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, John McDonough from Harvard University. Don't miss it. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, 34 after the top of the hour. Filling in for Tom all afternoon, I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. We're talking about healthcare. We are at the Families USA Health Action 2013 conference in our nation's capital, talking about healthcare policy and action. Joining me now to talk about some new polling that's come out recently about the popularity of expanding Medicare and Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act is Dr. John McDonough. He is a professor of public health practice at the Harvard School of Public Health and the director of the Harvard School of Public Health Center for Public Health Leadership. Dr. McDonough, thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here.
So you maintain this kind of political slash healthcare policy related blog at the Boston Globe, and you had this great piece about some interesting new findings from a poll done by the Kaiser Family Foundation, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard School of Public Health that finds some interesting information that maybe the people at Fox News would like to close their ears and eyes and say, nah. What did it find?
Well, it found basically that the public supports and wants to protect Medicare, which we knew, that's not a surprise,
right.
Medicaid, which we know has been growing in public support, and also the insurance expansions within the Affordable Care Act.
So the idea that you can't be denied because of pre-existing conditions, you can't reach a cap when they're
yes.
paying for your coverage, your children can stay on your plan until they're 24.
Yes, but even more than that, beginning next January, you'll be able to, if you're uninsured, get health insurance coverage with subsidies based on your income to make it affordable for you. And the public likes that idea. What's clear and what continues is that when you talk about the Affordable Care Act or ACA or Obamacare,
I take John Fugelsang's approach. I call it Obamacare, just like the right wing wants me to, and I started calling Social Security FDR care, and I started calling Medicare LBJ care, and
terrific.
I still call the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy.
Fantastic. When you talk about the law as a whole, there's still a sharp divide in public opinion, and what's also clear is that when you pull out component pieces, they are pretty significantly popular.
That's probably a result of 3 years of relentless browbeating with very basic terminology where people don't necessarily understand. You can describe the elements of Obamacare to somebody and they're going to support it by a very large margin.
Yes.
But when you call it Obamacare or when you call it the health care reform bill that the president signed into law, it becomes partisan again.
And there's other polling, not this one, but other polling which shows that when asked about what's in the law, Americans, by a large percentage, believe that there are things in the law that are bad that are actually not there, like
death panels.
And also, when they're asked whether they believe that there are good things that they like in the law, they don't really believe that they are in the law to begin with. So the law as a whole, in terms of marketing, has been a big belly flop for a lot of reasons, and the individual components that protect people and help people are overwhelmingly popular.
Well, one of the reasons, I mean, we as progressives didn't do we were divided on the subject. If you want to talk about where this compromise came from, well, a large number of progressives wanted a single-payer insurance plan. That's not what we ended up getting. Then we wanted the public option, which was a conservative plan.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't end up getting that. So the compromise is what we ended up with. So we did not do a very good job as a movement articulating what the ultimate result was. And President Obama, let's be honest, he's never been good at taking victory laps.
Mm-hmm.
When he gets a success, he goes right back to work on the next thing.
Yes.
If he was President Clinton, he would have done 3 weeks touring the country to explain what had just been signed into law and how great it's going to be for everybody. But this president is more professorial in his wanting to get to the next subject, move on and get the next thing done.
Absolutely. Right. And that just keeps going on, and that's been part of the process that's happened that's made it really difficult to sustain public support.
Well, and thankfully, the House may have voted umpteen times to remove ACA, but that
32.
Yeah, 32, but that didn't mean that it went anywhere. And I feel like we may have done a good job messaging, but as more and more people feel the impact of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, they're going to forget everything they were told and get to a point, because one of the things that they'll get to a point where they undoubtedly support it. One of the things that we take for granted, Social Security is popular now, Medicare is popular now, but the fights over enacting those pieces of legislation were just as severe as they were compromises, frankly. I mean,
Absolutely.
Those were results of attempts by previous presidents to bring national health care to the country, and they resulted in Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
They resulted in Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah.
So we always like to look at nostalgia and think that things were so much easier and tamer and more bipartisan back then.
Well, there's even more when you talk about Social Security. Most people don't understand the original law that Franklin Roosevelt signed excluded from any Social Security benefits, all agricultural workers, all domestic workers, all hospital workers, all government workers, all workers in firms with fewer than 10, so much so that more than two-thirds of working African Americans and more than half of working women were entitled to no benefits under the Social Security law. And it, starting in 1939, Congress gradually began filling in those holes and those gaps. But it wasn't until the early 1950s that we really had the Social Security law that people recognize today.
Right.
And that's familiar. I mean, Medicare and Medicaid started in 65, but that wasn't the end of building that foundation. It was only the start of a new phase. And similarly with the ACA, there are a lot of gaps, a lot of problems, a lot of flaws,
right.
And I could tell you all of them over 3 hours, but there is now the opportunity to fix those and build and move forward.
Right. And well, you'll hear right-wingers back during the debate say, this is just a plan to give everybody health care,
mm-hmm.
eventually. Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Pretty much.
And if you want to be the people that say that people don't deserve health care.
But it's also a plan to give people better health care,
right.
And give them better value for their money, and two, for the people who already have it. And that's an important piece, too.
You talk about, from an economic conservative standpoint, it's a plan to save money.
Yes.
I mean, if you look at the lifespan of somebody who's raised with health insurance through their entire adult life having health insurance,
mm-hmm.
we will save so much more money than people who have gaps in coverage.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a fact. And when you've got people, young people today, starting off in the hole when it comes to employment, if they've got insurance through their life, regardless of whether they're employed or not,
mm-hmm.
we're going to save untold amounts of money on the population as a whole.
And you mentioned Obama not doing a good job taking victory laps for what he does. It is also true that in the almost 3 years now since the law has signed, we've seen the lowest rate of increases in Medicare costs and in general health insurance costs than we've seen at any point in the past couple of decades.
Well, I mean, one of the things that the ACA did was force insurance companies who are taking this money to actually, A, you're going to give rebates if you're spending too much money on marketing
mm-hmm.
and too much money on overhead,
mm-hmm.
And because those are not comparable problems in Medicare, Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
And you've started, you'll see on Twitter and Facebook from time to time people posting photos of checks they got from their insurance company
mm-hmm.
for $250 or $18.15.
Yep. Never happened before.
Never having received a check from them ever.
Yeah, ever.
Because their provider spent too much money on marketing that month.
Inconceivable. And now it's happening. Billions of dollars to
consumers. The mistake of Obama versus Bush. When Bush gave the tax cut, we all got a check in the mail with his name on the envelope.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, there should have been a piece of the ACA that said, and the checks will say Obamacare on them.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Absolutely. But what are you going to do?
Well, you got to do this.
Yeah.
You got to go out there and educate people. For people that want to follow your work, they can go to the Boston Globe, and your blog is called Health Stew.
Health Stew, right.
And
just Google Health Stew, it'll take you there.
It's important stuff to follow. The fight is not done.
Mm-hmm.
Every day there's a fight in Washington to mm-hmm. either repeal Obamacare in whole or to deny it funding.
Mm-hmm.
They will stop at nothing because they know that this will get more popular with time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also, by the way, I wasn't in the bio to you, but I worked in the United States Senate between 2008 and 2010. For Senator Kennedy's committee,
the Health Committee
on the
Health Education,
writing of the Affordable Care Act, and after I got out of the Senate, I wrote a book called Inside National Health Reform, which a lot of people have found is a very helpful way to understand.
You've literally written the book, and people can find it on Amazon, right?
Yes, easy. Inside National Health Reform.
You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's one of those books that if you want to understand the entire debate that we're having and the policy that's at stake and what's been enacted, it's a great place to start with getting
mm-hmm.
the fundamentals.
Yeah, and I find when people actually find out what's in the law versus what they're told is in the law, there's a lot of surprise, and for the most part it's pleasant surprise. It's not completely pleasant surprise.
Well, even if you think you know what's in the law and you are an educated progressive who listens to talk radio and watches cable news and reads the newspaper and reads the blogs,
right.
It's still important to know the fundamentals because you're going to be interacting with people who don't know the fundamentals.
Yes, and I think the media, for the first couple of weeks after the law was signed, made a very serious concerted effort to try to explain the law to the American public, and I think a lot of it was very helpful and very good. But then after those first couple of weeks, they said, well, that job's done, and
right.
then they go on and talk about the food fights and things that are going on, but the public... Again, public opinion has forgotten what they knew when the law was signed.
Well, because the coverage may have stopped, but the mm-hmm. fight And the conservative echo chamber of always relentlessly attacking. You listen to conservative politicians who are every day talking about repealing Obamacare. That's where you end up having this. And the media is still stuck in the way that they used to be, where they were the only megaphone that mattered. And that's not the case anymore.
Yes. Lots of good sources. Kaiser Family Foundation, Commonwealth Fund. Great places to learn about it. Pew.
If you're just joining us, this is the Tom Hartman Program. We've been talking to Dr. John McDonough. He's a professor of public health and practice at Harvard School of Public Health. He's also the director of the Harvard School of Public Health Center for Public Health Leadership. More about him, you can go to his blog, Health Stew, at the Boston Globe. Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, this is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in, I'm Carl Frisch. We'll be here all afternoon. You won't want to miss our next guest. We're talking to Sister Simone Campbell. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, Sister Simone Campbell from Nuns on the Bus. I cannot wait. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom all afternoon. I am Carl Frisch. More about me at CarlFrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. My next guest is somebody I've been looking forward to talking to all afternoon as a former Catholic school kid. It is my pleasure to introduce Sister Simone Campbell. Sister, thanks for joining us.
Oh, great to be with you.
With Nuns on the Bus, you can follow the hashtag Nuns on the Bus. You can also go to networklobby.org or follow Sister Simone on Twitter, Sister, SR underscore Simone. Or Network Lobby on Twitter as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here. It's great.
I'm so used to talking to sisters in a very different setting where I'm saying, I apologize, and do I really have to write this 500 times on the blackboard?
Well, don't worry about that because I never taught school, so relax. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a school teacher.
Well, there you go.
It's all right.
But the work you're doing is very important. I noticed on Twitter, and really follow Sister Simone on Twitter, that you want the president to talk more about poverty. We were talking before we came back on that, yes, from a purely statistical point of view, and this is where numbers tell lies, the country overall is doing better than it was 6 years ago if you just look at numbers. But when you start to dig a little bit into those numbers, people who really need help, the poor, the middle class, the lower middle class, are not doing any better. If anything, they're doing worse.
They're doing worse. Actually, the incomes have gone down in the among the working poor. And most of that's because those who are working for minimum wage ended up having, in this recession, having hours cut, having to give up some hours, or not losing their second job, so that the actual income to low-income families has gone down. It's pretty shocking. It's shocking that in our nation, the wealthiest nation on earth, that you could work full-time and still live in poverty.
Or more than full-time.
More than full-time.
We talk
exactly.
about unemployment, but there's also, you know, overemployment, where you've got, you know, four incomes from two people in one family, or three incomes from one person in one family, and it's still not making enough to make ends meet.
Right, that's true. We met a man and his wife in Milwaukee when we were on the bus last summer, and he's working, his wife's working, but they're still living in poverty, and they only had enough money to pay the rent, and so they used food stamps to pay food for themselves and their two kids, and they came to St. Benedict's dining room every night for dinner because they knew they'd get nutritious food, and they had a teenage boy who was just devouring all the food that he could get a hold of at
Well, and it's a particular problem. I was talking earlier in the show that, you know, during the 60s, a lot of grocery stores burned down during riots, and they were never rebuilt. So if you happen to be poor in an inner city or an urban environment, not only may you not be able to afford food, but even if you have the modest means to be able to afford to put food on the table, you might not be able to get food in your neighborhood. Or anywhere near your neighborhood. I mean, we take for granted the idea that you wouldn't have to spend an hour going to a grocery store.
And then carry bags home on a bus.
Right.
I mean, that's absolutely true. The other challenge that I think that we have on, with regards to food is the idea of nutritious food, of fresh food. I live here in D.C. in, I mean, it's an okay area. It's a real mixed area.
Right.
But we know that we get food from the high-rent district.
Right.
we get fresh, quote, fresh vegetables that are a little more marginal than
right.
other stores. And so our quality is not as good. It makes, but our prices are about the same. So
right.
we end
if
up
you
paying
wanna,
more
for less.
For less.
And if you're listening at home and you want to know what that experience is like, I ask you, go find one of the chain grocers and go into an inner city version of it and see how different it is. It is remarkably different. And that's just one of the problems. And all of this comes down to personal security. When you are stressed out about your job, the likelihood that you're going to get sick is even higher. And what happens when you get sick without health insurance? All of these things play into our personal security that FDR used to talk about, you know, freedom from want, you know,
right.
freedom from, you know, basically being secure in life.
Well, but the thing that FDR knew that we need to relearn is that it is socially that we are secure, that our security is not an individualistic piece.
Right.
Our security is only if we're in this together. And communally, we do better when we are connected to each other and not afraid of each
and
other.
And bonus points, we do better economically when we're all doing better.
Yes.
The economy does better. Rich people do better when poor people do better.
Exactly. Henry Ford was right. Henry Ford knew, the genius of Henry Ford, besides the automobile creation, he knew that if his workers made enough money and could buy their product, that he would do better. And so he both paid higher wages and pegged the automobile at a price that his workers could afford.
And to hear that some people talk about it today, some corporatists talking about it today, it used to be a car in every garage, a chicken in every pot. Now it's a family in every garage. I mean, we've gotten
good
to the point where we don't value the things that we used to be proud about being an American, that most Americans could afford X, Y, or Z, that we took care of the least among us. We don't care about it. When I say we, I just mean it doesn't seem that we see the same compassion out there from the government or from people, leaders in industry.
Right, and I think a lot of this stems from September 11, 2001, and the response of fear, which was understandable in that moment, but that fear has been leveraged and used to divide us, to accomplish other political agendas.
Right.
And the whole miracle for me of the Affordable Care Act is we finally woke up enough as a nation to say it's shocking, it's wrong that in the richest nation on earth we have 50 million people without health care, and that we will stand up together and say that's wrong and make a change.
And I think it opens up in October of this year so that more and more people
yes.
can enroll in it.
Yes.
And I guarantee you, right now the numbers look divided on the subject because people haven't experienced what it's like to have this program
right.
that they've heard so
right.
many horrible things about, death panels, et cetera. But once people start, just like Social Security and Medicare, once people start having that coverage, once people start experiencing their ability to have
right.
those benefits, the numbers are going to flip to exactly what they should have been. You know, when you poll people about the ACA or Obamacare and tell them what's in it without telling them what you're talking
exactly.
about, it's extremely popular.
Well, it's absolutely popular. And the reason I am so passionate about making sure that Medicaid especially is expanded to cover low-income people, that's the principal way of expanding for low-income people, is because Margaret died in Cincinnati without health care when she lost your job, and that is wrong. You shouldn't lose your health care when you lose your job.
And you shouldn't have to choose between feeding your family, putting a roof over them, or taking them to the doctor.
Amen.
Sister Simone Campbell, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And you can follow them again, networklobby.org. Go there, sign up for their email list. Follow Sister Simone on Twitter, Sister_Simone, or Network Lobby on Twitter as well. Sister, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. I'm Carl Frisch. And we'll be back in the next hour with more great talk from the Families USA Healthcare Action Conference.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. We are at the Families USA Health Action 2013 conference, where we're talking about health policy and action that needs to be taken. We've got a lot of great guests this afternoon, and we've got even more coming up. But let's take Paul. He's on the phone with us. Paul?
Yeah, how you doing, Carl?
Good. What's up?
Oh, I'm a big fan of yours, Tom.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Yeah, before my comment, I have a quick question. Do married people really live longer than single people, or does it just seem longer?
It's probably a combination of both.
Yeah, could be. Yeah, I have a comment. You were talking about the imaginary death panels,
right?
Government death panels, and Obamacare actually eliminates the real death panels, which are the insurance companies.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they're not entirely eliminated, unfortunately, but they have historically been the death penalties, right? The death panels, right?
Yeah. Thousands of people a year die from being kicked off their insurance or denied insurance because they have a pre-existing condition. You know, that's literally been happening for, you know, decades.
Well, and it's so problematic if you think about it, and it's discouraging, too. I mean, what the health companies want you to do is just give up. It's unfortunate, but I want to thank you for your call, Paul. And if you want to give us a call, please do give us a call toll-free. We're taking your calls live from the Families USA Health Action 2013 conference, toll-free, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Joe in Virginia. Hey, Joe. Joe? Did we lose you? Joe, can you speak up?
Hello?
Hey, Joe.
Oh, hey, how are you?
I'm good.
I'm sorry it took a while. I wanted to address some of the points that you had with your guest about the gun control issue.
Sure.
I'm pretty much a libertarian, so I agree with you guys on about two-thirds of your positions.
All right.
Except when it comes to the gun issue, which I think true civil libertarians are really way off base on this issue. Almost every gun owner I know would not be happy with saying that you had to lock your guns up at a target range or
I didn't say that. I said if you wanted an assault rifle.
Absolutely nothing
Sir,
to do with
Joe,
shooting.
Joe, can you hear me? Joe, can
yes,
you hear me?
Yes.
I didn't say lock all your guns up, did I? I didn't.
Well, but you said that people would be happy with that.
No, that's not what I said, Joe. I think you need to listen a little bit more before you come to conclusions. I was talking about assault rifles, and I was very explicit when I said that. I can tell you from personal experience that not every gun owner would be happy with locking all of their guns up at a shooting range.
Right.
I've been to hundreds of gun shows, so I can tell you without fail that that's the case.
Yeah, well, I haven't been to hundreds, but I've been to probably 50 or 60. I doubt anybody's been to hundreds, but anyway. The second thing is if the left really cares about children being died by or killed by preventable things, why aren't they focusing on alcohol abuse, which a child has about a 200 to 300 times bigger risk? You want to talk about security, which is sort of the topic of your show here today. There's about a 200 to 300 times greater risk of a child dying from somebody abusing alcohol, whether it's a parent or
well, and Joe, that's an interesting point. I agree with you. Joe, I agree with you. So let's look at that issue. One of the reasons that number is so high would be from car-related alcohol consumption, right?
Yes.
And what do you have to do in order to have a vehicle? To drive it even legally? You have to have a license. Your car has to be inspected annually. It has to be registered annually. It needs to go
Why
in for a smog test.
Alcohol?
What's that?
Why not ban alcohol?
I'm not advocating for banning guns. I'm just advocating for registering and making sure that they're safe and that you still have them every year. I think those are all perfectly reasonable restrictions.
Why not have a test that in order to buy alcohol, you have to pass a test, you have to go through a background check, you need to have a license to buy alcohol, just like you need a license to drive a car. You can't go into a liquor store to buy alcohol unless you pass a background check. In other words, exactly the same type of regulations that you guys are trying to do on guns, do the same thing for alcohol. Say you can't buy more than 80 proof alcohol because that's the assault weapon equivalent of alcohol, and nobody, quote, needs that strong of alcohol to drink. I think when you start thinking like that, true civil libertarians...
Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem, Joe. True civil libertarians believe in something I call libertarian magic dust, that lack of government will solve every problem. And the point of fact is that alcohol is not made to kill people, okay? Guns are made to kill
people. Than gun do.
What's that?
It doesn't matter. It kills 100 times...
How would you know that? We don't keep track of how many people are killed by guns.
Yes, we do. 18,000 murders last year.
That we know of.
Killed by guns.
That we know of. The NRA spends countless dollars lobbying so that the federal government won't keep proper records. It's true. But we've got to take another call. I appreciate you calling in, but you need to get your facts straight before you call in. Thanks a lot, Joe. Let's take John in Minneapolis.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share with your listeners here and viewers that one of the most famous healthcare organizations in the country is, you know, going to put in $6 billion in infrastructure into Rochester, Minnesota to attract, I guess you would call it, high-end patients or medical tourism. And I think it's kind of gross, but, you know, that's just my opinion.
Would people want to go to the Mayo Clinic and stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, instead of putting it, I think, into patient care or maybe taking care of poor or indigent patients, which there are plenty of in the state that have no access, even though they live only, I'm in Minneapolis, it's about 70 miles from here. They are going to put in money to develop a world, quote, world-class attraction, Rochester, Minnesota, so that they can attract both high-end patients and then, I guess, also professional people. So I'm really glad that they're using patient care dollars that they've earned over the years, like vampires, I guess, using it for this kind of project. I think that's very humane, don't you? I mean, well, I'm sure the sisters who used to own the facility would have been really pleased with that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm being very, you know, tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, facetious. I understand.
Anyway, I just wanted to share that. You know, I don't know if the Cleveland Clinic is doing the same or some of these other, like John Hopkins, but I think it's kind of sad.
Well, I mean, what you're getting at is, and I want to thank you for your call, is that ultimately, you know, what it comes down to is lack of good coverage or lack of good care wherever you happen to be. And when you have a place that offers premium care, it only draws a spotlight to the fact that we don't have all access to something like that, particularly if you live in a state or in an area that is impoverished. You're not going to have access to even decent care sometimes. But it's how we live, and it's our, you know, duty as people who care about our fellow citizens to make it better. We got Pete in Illinois. Hey, Pete.
Oh, hello, sir.
How are you?
I'm very good. I just wanted to share my experience is that, you know, I have a felony on my record, and it's just for growing marijuana in the backyard. I had a bunch of seeds I was saving up, so I threw them in the ground. And, you know, I feel like I can never work again. I'm overqualified. I get hired wherever I go, and they always run a background check on me. So I can't get an $8.50 an hour job. But it's easier to get a gun. I hear, you know, 40% of these guns are they don't run a background check on that. What's that have to do with driving a
No, this is the problem, right? We don't do enough to protect people from guns, and we won't until Congress finally gets a backbone. This is the Tom Hartman Program. We're taking your calls, 866-987-8466. We'll be back with more great talk after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, we've got Rick Johnson from Lake Research. We're going to talk about what polls say on healthcare. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I am Carl Frisch. We are live at Families USA Health Action 2013. It's a great conference here in Washington, D.C., where we're talking about health policy and health action. And we're taking your calls toll-free, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. We're also going to chat with you when you call in. What do you think? Let's talk to Matt. Hey, Matt.
Yeah, hi, Carl. Thanks for filling in for Tom.
Oh, thank you.
I already have health insurance and through my employer, and I'm very unhappy with it. First of all, the deductible is $3,000, and whenever I actually go to use it, invariably everything costs a lot more. or this or that isn't covered and whatnot, and I'm just unhappy with it. And on top of that, at the end of this year, our employer, because they said their premiums were raised, my employer stopped contributing to our HSA program. So at this point, I'm actually worse off than I was a year ago. And what my question for you is, can I expect anything for a person like myself that already has health insurance to get any better?
In October of this year, so a little bit of ways away, you'll be able to enroll in these open plans that have specific things in place to keep people from being gouged like you are. I always tell people the story about when I fell off a cliff on Mother's Day of 2003. I had a Kaiser healthcare plan, and I went to the emergency room. They took care of me, and once you get a cast off, they want you to do physical rehabilitation. So I had just I got my cast off, and I moved, and I had Kaiser where I moved to in Vermont. And I went in to get a checkup, and they said, great, now you can start your physical rehabilitation, but you have to fly back to California where the accident happened in order to partake. So these are the issues that get hammered out when you don't have to worry about, losing insurance between jobs or pre-existing conditions. You know, you can take it's portable. You can take it from job to job and other places as well. Let's take Tom. He's listening in, I believe, Chicago. Hey, Tom. Oh, we lost Tom. Irene in Chicago.
Hello?
Hey, Irene.
Hi. I just want to talk about gun advocates and mental health and how the gun advocates are always saying, oh, we need to work on mental health. We need
yes.
to work on mental health. But the thing is if people can be mentally imbalanced, they can walk down the street talking to themselves, they can do crazy things, but if they don't have access to someone else's gun or a gun, they cannot harm anybody else. They can chase someone down the street. They can come at them with a knife, but they can't kill 20 kids if they don't have access to guns.
Well, it's the truth. And unfortunately, you talk to the NRA and they don't want to do anything about it. No changes whatsoever. Irene, thanks for your call. We do have a guest now here in our wide open studio. I've got Rick Johnson. He's a vice president at Lake Research Partners. They're a great polling outfit and research company here in Washington, D.C. Rick, thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So one of the things that I find remarkably interesting is that how so many of these issues relate to not just health care, but mental health care and the like. Recently, we had a discussion over, women in combat, now that women are serving in our military in the front lines openly as women in combat. And yet, people are shocked. Oh, my God, I can't believe you put women in combat. But we know now that women have been serving on the front lines in various capacities, whether as medics or technicians, in the front line, dying on the front line, but never getting the credit that they deserve, never getting the type of health care that you get when you serve in the front line. Lake Research had a poll out that said 3 in 4 Americans are in favor of allowing women to serve in combat roles, which is up 52% from just over a decade ago. Do you see that a lot in these cases? Do people take into consideration when they think about these broad issues? We've been talking about gun control because that is a serious public health aspect. Do people think about health care when it comes to these other issues, or do they compartmentalize it in their heads?
Well, I think that at first blush they compartmentalize it, and they want to address the primary issue first. So with women in combat, as an example, certainly they were thinking about, the rights of women, the ability of women to be able to do that. So it's sort of a should issue. Some of the ancillary issues that come up around that, though, I think that they, you might start thinking about that later. Well, what if or what about? Those things will start coming up. But really, at the end of the day, with something like women in combat, people look at that and say, fundamentally, it just doesn't make sense that women are not in combat. They should be allowed to have that role if that's what they wish.
Well, and, one of the things I've also been talking about, when you talk about the Affordable Care Act and you poll on the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, of course, John Fugel saying I believe him when he says, okay, we're going to call it Obamacare. We're also going to call Social Security FDR care and Medicare and Medicaid, LBJ care, and the Bush tax cuts. We're reading the Bush tax cuts. It gets a very divided polling. But if you don't even tell them what policy you're talking about, you say, would you support something that does X, Y, and Z? It's tremendously popular. How much do you think those numbers are going to change as people start to experience Obamacare?
Well, I think that, the more people learn about Obamacare, the more they like it. The more they get a chance to experience it, the more they like it. And, you know, as you clearly know, the rollout has been slow and purposeful. But when we got rid of pre-existing conditions, when it was made the law of the land that health insurance companies have to spend 80% of your premiums on care, and that if that's not the case, there's a rebate that's given to small businesses, you know, people like those ideas. People like to see that kind of policy. So absolutely, the more the people know, the more they're going to like it, and the more they get a chance to interact with Obamacare, the more they're going to like it.
Well, and how long do you think it'll take to reflect that in the polling? I mean, do you think it's something that, you know, the second somebody has a problem that they used to run into and they no longer have that problem, it affects the polling?
Well, the hard part is going to be separating Obamacare from, you know, just normal health care changes or normal health care activity. So, you know, if you get, so, you know, your disease is cured, was it Obamacare that cured you? Well, no, it wasn't. But getting access to those doctors at a reasonable price, yeah, Obamacare had a role.
So we just got to keep telling people, this is because of Obamacare. Rick, I want to thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, my
pleasure.
You
can find more about Lake Research at lakeresearch.com. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in. I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Coming up, more great talk. We want to hear from you. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-TOM, and we'll chat. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I am Carl Frisch all afternoon. It is 34 after the top of the hour. More about me at carlfrisch.com. You can follow me on Twitter, at Carl Frisch. Joining me now is a legend in his own right. I hope he doesn't mind me calling him a legend.
No, please. Wait, no, maybe not.
Dick Gregory, civil rights pioneer and comedian. We actually have a weird connection.
Uh-huh.
Your career really took off after you performed at the Playboy Club in Chicago. My Aunt Jeannie was a cocktail bunny.
Wow.
She served cocktails there. And when I was a baby, you know, toddler, she would serve me my sippy cups with juice in them the bunny style of tilting backwards.
How often did you talk to her?
Frequently enough.
Well, let me give you some good.
All right.
The Playboy was a phenomenon because it was a culture thing for the whole world.
Right.
Basically sophisticated, educated white men. It was the cleanest club in the world. You know, no prostitution, no shaking down anybody, nothing. And so there you went in, and it was right after the Kefauver investigation, found that 90% of the downtown bars for whites was tricks. They'd get your credit cards, and you couldn't dare tell nobody your credit card was missing and all that.
Right.
So when he opened up, there was about 1 million members all over the world that would never come to Chicago. But the sophistication, the culture thing, just to have the key, okay? Just to have, in other words, if you have a pass that gets you into the Super Bowl, you and for the rest of your life, if you never come to America, that's a culture thing. And so that's what, and so what happened was, when they went in there, instead of getting a shot, you got a double shot, okay? Nobody knew that. But you know you got a good drink. Now, anybody go to a club to eat dinner ain't into good food.
Right,
Caffeine. And so that's what happened. That's why it just took off so big. Big and big and big. They ran a clean ship. Okay? The hip thing was, the first time, see, before he brought me in, no Negro in America comic was permitted to work a white nightclub.
And this is where we get to the point where we're the year 2013, and, you know, you've got that right-wing talking point, we've got a black president, there's no more racism. People need to remember what it was like only 45 years ago.
Yeah, but that never changed. 45 years ago was physical.
Right.
See,
I want you to say it to my face.
Yeah.
You see, don't think it and not say it.
Yeah, but they're not.
Yeah.
You see, let me tell you something. When a white woman didn't get the right to vote till 1921 and she came over on the boat with the boy, if you do that to your mama, my mama better not come out the house.
I mean, yeah.
do you realize before the King movement, now think about this, man. Then you understand the universe. King was a Republican.
Right.
His mom and dad was right-wing Republicans. His grandmother and grandfather was right-wing conservative Republicans. You hear me?
Yep.
Now, everything King did, he didn't learn at home. Okay? Hear me good now. He didn't learn. Negroes wanted their children to go to school and go to college and be doctors to prove to white folks that we ain't dumb, like they say. Well, you violate the universal God when you want somebody to go to school to prove something.
Well, I was watching, I saw Lincoln the other night.
Yep.
And there's that moment in the movie, and you know, we only know what we're told,
yeah.
Right? So there's that moment in the movie when you realize that the whole debate over the 13th Amendment came down to one congressman being willing to stuff his pride. He believed that people were created equal.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But he stuffed his pride to get the amendment through by not admitting,
yep,
that black folks were just as capable and,
yeah, sure,
as white folks,
yeah,
and therefore it sailed through because you weren't saying that they were created equal.
Yeah.
You're just saying that they should get equality.
Okay, now let me tell you something. You go back and see that movie again. Let me tell you why.
Okay.
Lincoln came out of that kind of strange spiritual holy-roly stuff.
Yeah.
Okay? He believed not that all people was created equal. His Christianity told him that no person should work for free and nobody should be a slave.
Right.
He believed we was inferior.
Right.
Okay? And then all at once, see, Lincoln was gay. Okay? Had a black lover. That's what I'm telling you, go back and see the movie.
Yep.
Now let me show you how they put the little codes out. The gay wing of the Republican Party is called Log Cabin.
Right.
Who's the only president you ever read about in history lived in a log cabin? That's what.
Well, they chose their name for a specific reason. He's not the only. There's a lot out there about him, you know, sharing a bed with members of his protection and.
That was the right guy in the movie.
Yeah.
That was the one that brought him the gloves.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's why the wife went crazy. He said, "Let me tell you what we black folks know. If your father and mother own the largest cab company in this town." You know how much stuff they hear people talk about in the camp?
I'm sure.
So what do you think was the slave master, everything they was doing?
Yep.
We had shoeshine guys in these white places that would bring us tips back to black folks on what stock's going to be tricked tomorrow, what stock's going to do this. So we know history better than most folks because it gets passed down.
Sure.
It gets passed down. And so when you look at that movie, it was about wheeling and dealing.
Oh, yeah.
What about slaves? That's why a lot of people's mad they didn't see the Civil War.
No, it came down to passing because of bribery
and
government jobs. And
that's what it was about.
Well, I think what's remarkable to most people, because they think of it as like this grand gesture,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
It really came down to sausage making, just like everything else that happens in Washington.
Yeah, that's right. And it's everything.
It's no less noble.
Mm-hmm.
But it still came down to the exact same
thing.
That's
right.
It's not like there was a moment of clarity where Congress stood up and said, you know what, let's do the right thing,
yeah,
guys.
No. Well, let me tell you something. One of my great heroes, not at the top, my great hero, if I had to write 100 people that have lived on this planet, Jesus, Buddha, number one would be John Brown. Hmm? John Brown. Because
mm-hmm.
John... I'll die for liberation, especially liberation of black folks.
Right.
But I won't take my children. Hmm? John Brown took his two sons with him.
Yeah.
Two sons. Think about this. He got nothing out of it. There was no money to be rewarded for liberating black folks. Huh? He took his two sons. He asked Frederick Douglass to go. Frederick Douglass told me crazy. When Harriet Tubman died, she said, my one regret... But I'm ashamed I wasn't there to die with John Brown. Okay? Now, he had five black guys with him. One of them's name was Dangerfield Newby. Hmm? Now, out of all the stuff I know, this baffles me more than anything. Dangerfield Newby had a love letter in his pocket when he was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why them white folks with their mindset didn't burn everything up. The love letter still exists. That's... was Jumbo Unchained,
mm-hmm.
the movie?
Django
Unchained.
Yeah.
That's the role that Jimmy Fox was playing.
Mm-hmm.
He only went there, joined them, John Brown, to liberate his wife. That's what the story was about. And the first time you've seen a love story in America of two black folks where there wasn't no sex involved, first time you've seen a love story in America... where they ride off in the sunshine. In America, That movie had three top stars, two white and one black. The two whites get killed. The black cat got rides off.
You said the opposite.
You hear me?
If you see a black character in a white horror movie or Western movie, you know they're the first one to die.
Yes, yes. And so consequently, when I was in Europe the other day, and they was asking about the movie, and they said, oh, it was so incredible. You know, he said, but he did kind of play with history. I said, well, it had his slave wife, you know, speaking German. Are you aware of that?
Yeah.
Okay, I said, wait a minute. All slaves spoke the language of the master. Huh? If you live in Paris and you got a dog for 4 years and then send it to one of your children, the dog don't understand English. The dog understands French.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so Harriet Tubman, no one Sojourner Truth, she spoke Dutch because her owners was Dutch. People used to ask me, why Nick Rose speaks such bad English? I said, because we're around some bad English-speaking white folks. I was speaking pure Swahili until that white boy said, go yonder and get that bell, come bring the yah. But I said, if you go to Europe, England, where them white folks heard real English,
right,
they talk pure English.
They spoke the Queen's
so,
English.
Yeah, you know, and so it's one of those things where when you sit and think about John Brown, one man, then I get back to King, one man changed the whole world. Because what he did there, and then to show you the power of fear. The power of fear.
Absolutely.
Here's what happened. 1857, the raid. He's going, they got 100,000 guns and ammunition. We're going to take these guns and give it to 100,000 slaves. Now think about this now. Fear. There was no cars or trucks back then. How was 21 people?
Or paved roads.
Did you hear me? How is 21 people going to care 100? But fear, the fear of 100,000.
Forget failure. There is no failure.
No.
Yeah.
Now, here's when you know something big. When they went in there to make that raid, that was the government's munitions center. You know, they made the guns and the weapons.
Right.
Guarded by four divisions of Marines. They fought them for 4 days, so you know something, some other universe was there. Now, when they killed John Brown's two children, and he was wounded, they sentenced him to die. Okay, on December 2nd, he's killed.
Right.
Every December 2nd, I go to West Virginia. The tree is still there.
That's amazing.
The tree is still
there. Can you stick around for the next segment?
Yeah.
We've got another guest that's going to be coming in, but we'll just
be my pleasure.
Take a little bit more time. Yeah. We're talking to Dick Gregory, the comedian, civil rights activist. Fascinating stuff here. Stick around. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. I am Carl Frisch, and we will be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more with Dick Gregory, and we'll also be talking to Dee Mahans. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. 10 till the top of the hour, closing out the show today. This is Carl Frisch filling in for Tom all afternoon. Do me a favor, go to my website, carlfrisch.com, sign up for my email list, and follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Carl Frisch. That's KarlFrisch.com. If you're just joining us, we are talking to comedian and civil rights activist Dick Gregory, who's been kind enough to stick around for a little bit more of our conversation. We were talking about the legacy that we're kind of looking at now, and this weird prism that we're all in. I mean, you've got this media that ignores race, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't even talk about it.
Yes.
And then you've got a conservative apparatus who claims that there is no racism. Obama's proof that there's no racism.
Yes.
And you don't have to look back too far
to see it
in your face.
The great part about it is it shows like this. See, one time they had carte blanche.
Right.
We was locked into NBC, CBS, and ABC and nothing else.
Right.
And now there's 40,000 internet radio stations in America alone.
Right.
And so that's why every now and then the New York Times got to print some outrageous stuff to let all these folks that's been listening to the real stuff. And so when you take Dr. Martin Luther King, never had been around civil rights. See, back in those days, Negroes was talking about not liberation, education.
Right.
Not education for liberation, but education to teach white folks that all of us ain't like them.
Right.
And so consequently, he had never been around, so everything he got killed for, he didn't learn that in his house. Okay? He was picked to lead that movement in Montgomery, 1956. He was assassinated in 1968. It's hard, as close as I was to believe, he was just here 12 years doing that.
Right.
That seems impossible with everything he was able to do in 12 years, and the world changed. Now we go back to John Brown. The world changed with John Brown's Harper's Ferry because of fear. And then the other thing is that when you take the Second Amendment now, one of my heroes that would have been on that list, I took him off now, was James Madison. The reason Madison's name wasn't on the Constitution, because he refused to sign the document unless it called for end of slavery. Then when I get to looking at the stuff about the Second Amendment, there was an uprising in Alabama. A bunch of black Africans steal more African genes than Negro genes. They made their bolo lie, and they attacked white folks and beheaded about 40, killed about 200, and white folks were scared. That's where the Second Amendment come from. James Madison engineered that whole thing to protect ourselves from them. That's what it's for. And that's why they're having so much trouble with it now, because it was put there for one thing, and we got it on the false pretense.
Well, I always say, like, if you want to have a well-regulated militia of muskets, they had in that era, you can have as many muskets as you want, because I can run away from you in between bullets.
Yeah, well, wait, no, don't take that back.
Take it back.
The French weren't able to do that in Haiti.
Yeah, that's true. Dick Gregory, iconic comedian and civil rights pioneer, I want to thank you for being on the show.
Thank you,
Tony, you got to go to another show.
Yes, thank you so much.
So thanks so much for joining us, Dick.
Pleasure, brother.
I appreciate it. We're taking your calls all afternoon. We're coming up on the end of the show, but I want to get a few more in if we can. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Let's do Shane in Maryland. Shane, are you there?
Yeah, hi. I guess I just wanted to talk about something that isn't directly about civil rights, but it does actually touch on it for sure. And that is that it really we seem to live in a world now where we can't opt out of the system that's happening. We have to either consume, produce, or sell. And if we choose not to do this, we slip through the cracks and are incarcerated or institutionalized or, you know, made homeless until we're one of those two things anyway.
Well, I think that obviously, I mean, I don't think this country has ever been a place where, we made people feel comfortable for being different. But, perhaps that's something that can change over time. I want to thank you for your call, Shane.
Well, it actually won't. If you could think about the fact that everything around you is industrialized, we eat industrialized food, drink industrialized water.
Shane, I understand. I got to let you go. My next guest is here, and I want to get to her before we end the show. She is the director of Medicaid advocacy at Families USA, the sponsoring organization of this great conference that we've been at, the Families USA Health Action 2013 conference. Dee Mahan, thanks for joining me, Dee.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Americans are now moving more and more in favor of the Obamacare implementation. It's crazy. After 3 years of fighting or perceiving a fight going on, that they're now in favor of these very popular things that they must not have even known existed during the debate.
Well, you know, it doesn't really surprise us.
Right.
Once you start seeing what it can do for you and learn more about it. What we saw all along is when you talk to people about the provisions in the law.
As long as you didn't tell them what it was that you were describing, they were like, oh, yeah, of course.
You take it out of politics and they say, well, that sounds really good.
Well, even during the primaries, you had some Republicans saying, like, I want to keep this,
right,
and this, but I'm getting rid of all of Obamacare. It was a bit like saying, keep your government hands off my Medicare.
That's right. So, yeah, the thing, keeping kids on their parents' policies. And what's going to happen in 2014, being able to buy insurance.
Well, the enrollment begins in October of this year.
Yeah, it's really exciting because this is going to be, it's hard to believe, but the first time that people who have been denied and denied and denied health insurance for whatever reason will have an opportunity to get insurance no matter what their pre-existing condition is, and that's huge.
It's a big deal. I mean, and we've got to go in just a minute, but I want to ask you, you've been involved in this fight for a long time. Did you ever think you'd see the day?
I was sure hopeful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not the only generation of progressives who have been fighting for
this. I mean, there were moments,
there are multiple generations that are fighting for this.
There are, and there were certainly times when I'd say, this is never going to happen. I'm just beating my head against the wall. But you got to come back and keep doing it.
Right.
And our organization, our executive director, Ron Pollack, he has always been there saying, keep working on it, keep working on it.
And the fight has to continue or else they'll try and take it away, just like they're doing on Social Security and Medicare. Dee Mahan from Families USA, thanks so much for joining me. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in all afternoon. It's been a delight. I'm Carl Frisch. Check me out online at carlfrisch.com, and you can stay connected. Follow me on Twitter, and don't forget to check out familiesusa.org. They've done a great job with this conference, and they're doing a great job to fight and protect Social Security, Medicare, and health care reform.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dee.
Bye.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.